my hair today. And hey, everybody.
Microfiber towel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, everyone. I'm Janelle Pizarro.
And I'm Frederick Philip Von Weiss. And thank you for consuming the Thunder Nerds, a conversation with people behind the technology
that love what they do and do tech good.
Ah, do tech. Hey, and we're at Event Apart, and we're talking with Dan Maul. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. Dan, you are the founder and design director at Super Friendly, which sounds like a very friendly place.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're also a teacher.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's cool. Could you mind telling us a little bit about you and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a designer. I'm a creative director. I went to school for design, grew up drawing and doing design. And so now I run an agency, which is a little bit of a different agency. And my role is kind of like a director on films, where my job is to just make sure that all the actors and all the people doing the work are doing their best work and trying to get that out of them.
That's awesome. That's a really good metaphor.
I pitched it a couple times before.
Cool. So what is your talk going to kind of be about today? You're speaking later on today, right?
And yeah, I love right. The title of Till Launch, Do Us Part.
That's right. Yeah. So my talk is about the designer-developer relationship. And I think that, you know, a lot of these conferences that we go to talk about how designers and developers should collaborate and work together. And I think no one really disagrees with that. But what I find is when I work with designers and developers, especially at in-house teams that my agency works with, they don't really know how to collaborate. And they think that they do until, you know, me and my team kind of come in and say, this is what it looks like to really engage and work with each other. So my talk today is going to be about like tips and tricks and like really actionable things as to how designers and developers can sit together, work together, not do the whole throw it over the wall thing, how to really engage with each other. And I think that leads to better work.
Did you have a personal Phil Collins or Genesis experience that made this happen?
You know, I think I've been lucky in my career to work with people that know how to collaborate and have sort of taught me how to collaborate. And so I always just thought, well, this is how it is. This is how it goes until I went to, until I start working with clients and I go like, oh, they don't do this. And oh, it's because they don't know how to do this. So I kind of took it upon myself to be like, all right, well, somebody's got to show them. Right. So I might as well be the one.
That's awesome. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's super nifty. I have just kind of a little bit. He's a designer,
Okay. Like
super awesome. And then I'm a dev, and you know we butt heads all the time.
Sure,
we don't work together.
No, we don't actually butt heads. Nice.
No, but you know it is difficult to kind of like have that conversation with your designer or vice versa, right? With your developer and be like, hey, this thing needs to move exactly 4 pixels to the left, and like having those like really difficult conversations about really honestly just 4 pixels. How would you go about, you know, telling designers and developers how to make that problem work?
Well, so I think the first thing is it's about the relationship, right? So a lot of people approach it thinking, well, no, it's all about the work. And what that kind of says, and like I get the sentiment of that, it's usually a positive one, which is like, no, we're all in it to make a great product. But the subtext of that is sort of like, well, I don't care about you because this is all about the work. And so I find that the first thing is like, well, we have to like each other and trust each other and make sure that what you're saying is in my best interest too. And if I know that, well, now I have an incentive to do what you're asking me to do. And I have an incentive, and you have an incentive to do what I'm asking you to do. So I think a lot of that is just like, how do you find trust? How do you find
partnership?
The ability to like, because collaboration is really about joining together. It's a merger of sorts, right? And so I think it's a lot like that, where you have to have trust first. And then if there's trust, now you can start to do things that complement each other and help each other. So I think help is a lot of it. And then aside from that, on a tactical end, I find a lot of times developers are doing a lot of work that designers should be doing, and designers are actually doing a lot of work that developers should be doing. Mm-hmm. So from the tips and tricks standpoint, I'm like, well, let's separate those two things and let's have designers kind of take back some of the part that should be on them. Right? A lot of times developers are finishing the design in the browser. Jen Simmons said that yesterday in her talk.
Yeah.
They're finishing design work, and yet designers don't do anything to enable good design for developers and vice versa. So a lot of what I've been thinking about lately is, well, how do we flip that a little bit? How do we let designers kind of own more of the design process and developers own more of development, but also vice versa, have developers be in on the design process, designers in on the development process?
Do you have any kind of takeaways from that? Any kind of things that you've employed in the field that you find some results with that?
So one popular one that I think people don't take advantage of right now is, you know, design systems are a big topic right now. Mm-hmm. And part of design systems are this concept of tokens. Right, so tokens are things that you can declare abstractly, right? You can create a file somewhere, whether it's JSON or XML or something, that has all of your colors, your typefaces, your rounded corner radius. that's typically a developer's job, write a JSON file or an XML file. But if you think about all the stuff that is in a tokens file, it's all design stuff. So why aren't designers owning tokens? So a lot of the things, so that's one of the things that I talk about a lot. It's like, well, how do you get a designer to own a tokens file? How do you set up the workflow? How do you set up the tooling? You know, so that a designer's not like going to set up Gulp and build tools and all that stuff on their machines, but how can they own a really abstract file so that if they want to move this thing 4 pixels to the right, it's about editing a configuration file rather than sitting with a developer and going, 2 pixels up, please. 1 pixel, could be 2.5 pixels, you know, like that. Over the shoulder that people don't really like to do.
Do you think it's more of like a trepidation of getting actually into development for a designer? And how do we overcome that? How do we make development not so scary?
Yeah. So I'm a people person. I like to talk about the touchy-feely stuff because it impacts our work so much. Mm-hmm. I'm a designer, but I find that if you can make people comfortable, they tend to do better work.
Yeah.
And so for me, the trepidation with designers is not that code is hard. I mean, that might be one part of it, but most designers can get over that. The trepidation is, if I don't do a good job here, am I going to get fired?
Yeah.
Right? That's the thing. Developers, well, you own the design. Okay, but if I don't do a good job, am I going to get fired?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this, especially in a workplace that is, you know, that's tough, a lot of what people are worried about is like, I have to do a good job, otherwise my livelihood is in the line.
Right.
If you can remove that part of the equation, that opens the door to a lot more different conversations. So how can a designer say to a developer, I'd like you to own some of this design part, but if it doesn't go well, that's cool, it'll be on me. And actually mean it and actually be willing to take accountability and take willingness for that. So I find that a lot of it is just like making people comfortable with that. And how do you remove the risk from them? The risk is I'm gonna get fired. I don't have this job. I have to support my family.
Mm.
All of that stuff is wrapped up into, can we move that thing 4 pixels to the right?
You get so many people that will say like, oh, that's not my job. Mm-hmm. I'm going to distance myself. That's so-and-so. That's Carl down the block there. He does that.
That's right.
I do this. I'm safe.
And it's exactly that too. It's like, well, if things go wrong, I want the blame to be over there, not over here.
Exactly.
And so if you can take that out of the equation, if you can remove that from the dynamic of workplaces, I feel like it opens up the door to a lot of different possibilities.
How do we go down that road?
I think a lot of it is trust.
Okay.
You know, in order for you to do something for me, the easiest way that I can get you to do that is I have to do something for you first. So if I can do something for you first, I think it'll make you more likely to do something for me.
We're both providing value and then
that's right. But I've got to start. I can't ask you to do something and me not do anything yet.
Yeah.
I have much more likelihood if I go, hey, can I grab you a beer from the fridge? And you're like, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
And then I grab you a beer or I buy you a pizza and hey, you mind sitting with me while we do this design thing? It's much easier than, hey, I need you to do this by the end of the day. I'm actually going home because I got to go, I got to go paintballing tonight. But, you know, good luck staying late.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that. You know, so I think a lot of it is what can you do first for someone else?
Yeah.
And then I think they'll be much more likely to do it for you.
So I have a bit of a question of sometimes a lot of people will like internalize that like blame game kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And someone down the pipeline will be like, okay, this is my fault. No matter what, even if it's not their fault at all, right?
Yep.
How would you counteract that kind of feeling too? Because I mean, at the end of the day, someone might even just be like, oh, it's totally my fault. I talked to somebody who knew about the thing, and so now it's my fault, and I got to fix it.
Yeah, so I got a couple of tools to help with that. So the first tool, and certainly it's not things that I made up. These are things that I found that other people created that I'm like, that's super useful. The first one is called a RACI matrix. And a RACI matrix, it's RACI. It stands for responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. And what I do at the beginning of every project is I list out all of the roles that people will have to do on this project. So, all right, we got to make icons, we got to do comps, we have to, you know, write HTML, we have to write CSS, we have to write all the things that we're going to do on this project. And then across the top, we write all the roles, or even sometimes more specifically, all the people, you know, Jenny and Kyle and Jim and Bob. And I write, you know, an R, a C, an A, or an I. So Jenny is responsible for the icons. Carl is responsible for the HTML. This person is accountable for this thing. And it very clearly delineates, okay, if things go wrong, who is the person that will accept responsibility?
God.
But also, who is the person that should get the credit? If the icons come out killer, Jenny, we are promoting you. Like you're gonna get the reward from this too. And you know, some people are not comfortable being responsible for anything. And that's okay. This makes it plain. I just want to be informed about everything, but I don't want to be responsible. Great. Mm-hmm. Kyle, you have no R's on your side of the chart. And so using a chart like that makes it visible, kind of makes it transparent. Like, these are the people that are responsible for these things. If I want to know who's in charge of the icons, I can just look at this chart and go, oh, it's Jenny. She's in charge of the icons. I can go talk to her about that. So that's one tool for doing that, is like just making that really transparent. Because a lot of times we assume, like, I guess the designer's in charge of the icons, right?
Yeah.
But no, a product manager actually decided we're going to use some stock icon set. But I don't know. I go to the designer because I don't know those things. So if we can make those things more visible, it becomes a great way to kind of help people to know, you know, what they're going to get blamed for and what they're not going to get blamed for. So that's one thing. I forget what the second thing is, but so we'll stick with the first thing.
Do you find it's easy to take that information and bring it into one's employer and say, you know what, I'd like to kind of set this into our culture?
Yeah.
Yes, and thank you for reminding me, because that's part of the second thing, is that I think leadership has to be involved in that too. And so how can you make it so that people know what praise or what blame they're going to get? Is I think leadership should be involved to set up those things for the people that are underneath them and working for them to say, you know, I think the job of a good leader is to say, if things go well, you all get the praise because you all did this. And if things go poorly, it's my fault for not setting this up for you. So I think leadership should certainly be part of that culture. And that could be top down or it could be ground up. It could be designers and developers, you know, saying to their managers, hey, I'd like to implement this tool into our culture. Let's bring it up every day at stand up, or let's build a Slack bot around this, or something, whatever the internal culture is. But it also could work top down, where a manager could say, hey, I have this tool that I think was going to help our team and help me to articulate what I'm supposed to be doing for you. So I think that it could work either way.
That's killer. I love it. So I have a question.
Okay.
Do you play piano?
I do.
Tell me about that.
Okay. I played the piano since I was 3.
Started late. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. kind of a late bloomer. I played the piano since I was 3. I always liked doing it. I used to have a little Casio keyboard that I would carry with me to church every week. And the pastor at the church every week would be like, hey, Dan, you have a song you want to play for us? And I'd like march to the front of the church and play a little song.
That's adorable.
And so I've always been used to being in front of crowds since I was 3. Played in bands before. And my parents never forced me to play the piano. And so I think that's the reason that I stuck with it. Is like, I was never like, my parents were never like, you have to practice, you have to do this.
Saturday piano lessons, Dan.
I mean, I did it because I wanted to do it. And yeah. There were times where I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And my parents were like, all right, well, you don't have to.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I guess I have autonomy here. So it was cool. They gave me a lot of capacity to decide what I wanted to do with it. And so I keep doing it now.
Sounds like you guys have great parents.
I do. I do have great parents. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very Gene Belcher. I love it.
It's very what? Gene?
Gene Belcher.
Right.
From Bob's Burgers.
Right.
Yeah, carries a little keyboard.
That's
everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. It's great.
That's a good reference.
That is good.
It's my favorite.
So what kind of bands did you do?
I play mostly in Christian bands.
Christian bands.
Well, so I played in 2 bands before. One, I played for 10 years as a Christian band. And then my first band that I was in, I played maybe 2 shows, and I don't remember the name of the band. It was either, so we either had a song called The Morning After, or the name of the band was The Morning After. I don't exactly remember.
It's that long ago.
No, it's not that long. It was just so short-lived that I was like, I don't even know. Like, I don't know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And you're in a band now?
I'm not. I have a wife and 2 kids, and that takes up most of my time.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
Maybe a family band one
day.
Yeah. Do you got the young kids?
I have a 6-year, well, I guess she's 7 now. She just turned 7. A 7-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 2 daughters.
Yeah, that takes up a lot of time. I've got a 3.5-year-old. And yeah.
I understand.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
But they're all musical. My wife sings. She's an amazing singer. Like, she's like the kind of singer that's like wins karaoke competitions kind of singer.
Dang.
She's the kind that, like, you know, people go up to sing karaoke and then she goes up and they're like, oh, you're a singer. And so it's like, it's a bit unfair.
Do you mind if I ask you, like, so what got you into what you're doing now? Like, you were on a fast track to becoming a piano
That's right.
Genius. How did you get into this?
So speaking of my good parents, my dad is an accountant. My dad is a very pragmatic accountant. And so, like, I have Asian parents. Both of my parents are of Asian descent, and atypical for Asians. Like, they didn't want me to be a doctor or a lawyer. My dad, just the only career advice he's ever given me was like, whatever you do, make sure you can support your family. Okay. If you want to have a family, make sure you can support them. So when I was like in high school and trying to decide, like, do I want to do this like an art thing? Cause I always drew and read comic books growing up. Do I want to do like kind of an art thing or like a music thing? And I was like, I think that music would be a difficult life. At 16, I knew that.
Nice, good for you.
Yeah, and so I was like, all right, maybe I'll see what this art thing does. So I went to school to be an animator because actually I in 91, 92, I think it was when Toy Story came out. And I saw Toy Story and I was like, yep, that's it. That's what I want to do.
Sold.
Yep. And so I went to school to be an animator, and I realized in my first semester how difficult animation actually is.
Yeah.
And how I'm not cut out for it. But I was lucky to, my major was sort of split between animation and design. And I was like, oh, this design thing actually is pretty cool. And so,
oh, that's so
it
cool.
all started there.
Oh, nice. You fell into it. That's really
I did, awesome. Yeah, almost literally.
and you worked in Lucasfilms?
I worked with Lucasfilm. So I did, at one point, as part of my claim to fame, is I designed StarWars.com. Not the version that's up right now, but the version just before Disney bought it.
Dadgum, nice. That's pretty cool.
Yep.
All right, nice.
So that's certainly a high point in my career.
That is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I talk about that all the time.
yeah, it goes in every pitch that I do.
First, gonna start my slide with Star Wars, and we'll go into the talk. I don't know how relevant it is, but yeah.
You know, a big photo of Darth Vader is always a hit.
Love it, so awesome.
Well, Dan, for our audience, the people that did not have an opportunity to join us at Event Apart this week, do you mind providing any kind of little goodies or takeaways from your talk?
Yeah, totally. So I think for my talk, my talk is called To Launch, Do Us Part. And it's really about engaging with designers and developers and how they can do that more closely. Like we talked about here, I think trust is a big part of that. The other part is find tooling and find ways to really sit together. I think that's maybe the best part of it. And that doesn't mean you have to be all in the same location. Find ways to virtually sit together. So one thing that me and my teams will do, even though we're distributed, is we'll send videos back and forth. And it's almost like my video will talk to that person's video, and then we'll do that. Brad Frost, who's on stage a little bit later today, he and I did a 2-hour YouTube video of, like, here's just how we work together as designer and developer. So if you want to see what that process looks like, you can check out that video on YouTube.
That's really cool. Okay, great. Yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Cool.
Dan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Super appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, and stay tuned. We're going to have a lot more speakers coming up soon. Thanks for consuming the Thunder Nerds. We honestly and sincerely appreciate you watching and or listening to the show. Please subscribe on YouTube and iTunes. Write us a review, kick a few stars our way. And above all else, please remember to send your favorite book suggestions to Brian Hinton.
I like romance novels. They have happy endings.
I should have known the Territor didn't mean us any harm when the Sword of Omens didn't obey me. And anyway, it was just plain stupid to assume it might be bad. Just what the fuck am I talking about?